Welcome to another interview provided by WishlistProducts.com. Very recently, we had the privilege to be able to track down and conduct a very special phone interview with best-selling author Dan Ariely. Dan is the author of the New York Times bestseller Predictably Irrational, as well as a brand new book just released called The Upside of Irrationality. Dan is a professor of psychology and behavioral economics at Duke University. His work has been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Washington Post, the Boston Globe, Business 2.0, Scientific American, and Science. He's also appeared on CNN, CNBC, and is a regular commentator on American Public Media's Marketplace. Dan's first book, Predictably Irrational, opened our eyes to the myriad of many irrational decisions that we make on a daily basis. In this interview, we're going to be talking to Dan about what those decisions mean to small business owners. How do your customers react when they are making a financial decision of whether they purchase your products or not? And can we control that environment? Can we enhance it so that we increase sales? We're also going to talk to him about free and what the word free means to you and your business. We're also going to explore the freemium business model and whether that is a right or wrong decision to make long term. We also talked to Dan about the effects of expectations and what expectations can mean for your sales of your products before the consumer even buys them or experiences them. We then begin to explore concepts from his brand new book, The Upside of Irrationality. And we open that book by talking about bonuses and what that means to you as a small business owner. Do you give bonuses to contract workers or employees? If so, does a bigger bonus mean a better performance? You're going to find out in this brand new interview. So sit back, grab a pen and a paper, because part one of this interview is a doozy, and you're going to hear so many great ideas that you can begin applying in your own business, whether it's pricing your products or whether it's setting expectations. The key thing to note is that customers make irrational decisions all the time. The key for us as small business owners is to understand the type of irrational decisions they make and then adjust ourselves accordingly. So get ready as we begin this fantastic interview with best-selling author Dan Ariely. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Stu McLaren, co-founder of WishlistProducts.com, and I am very, very excited here today because I'm joined by Dan Ariely. And Dan is the best-selling author of Predictably Irrational and now the new book called The Upside of Irrationality. And as a business owner myself and certainly somebody with a marketing background, both of these books have been fantastic in terms of giving us insights into the rational and irrational behavior of everyday people such as you and I. So with that, Dan, welcome to today's call.
Well, lovely to be here.
Awesome, Dan. Now, before we get started talking about specific chapters of the book and content from within each of the books, can you give everybody a little background on what is irrational and what is rational in terms of decision making?
Yeah. So, you know, the economic theory gives people a framework to think about how people make decisions. And it has some truth to it, so it's not that people never behave according to economic principles, but it turns out that it's not a perfect descriptor of the complex motivation that we as human beings have. And when you say it like this, it sounds so trivial, and nobody should ever question this idea, but the fact is that I think we all have kind of studied economics a little bit too much and kind of have been captured a little bit too much by the beauty and elegance of economic theory. And because of that, we take it a bit too serious.
Yep.
And we think it applies more broadly than it actually does. So that I think is kind of the basic issue. Now, you know, there's a lot of definition of rationality, but the thing that bothers me the most is the idea that when people make mistakes in predicting how people would behave,
Right.
So, for example, if you think that people would behave a certain way, and it's not rational, in a strictly speaking way, but you still can predict it, then there's no problem. For example, you know, it turns out that when people go to have lunch in a restaurant, they often say to themselves, this time I'm not going to overeat, and I'm not going to order the dessert, and I'm going to control my eating. And often when the dessert tray comes, they fail. They see the chocolate souffle and they say, yes, I'll have that.
I think we can all relate to that.
Yeah. And, you know, this is just one example, but we all relate to this in terms of procrastination and overeating and under-exercising and having unprotected sex, lots and lots of stuff like that. And if we understood that we made mistakes and we would predict it every time, there will be no problem. I mean, it will not be rational, strictly speaking, but it will not pose a problem on human behavior. The problem is that when we have a different model of the world, that what the world really works accordingly. And that's where both business owners can make tremendous mistakes, and I've seen lots of those, as well as individuals.
And I think, too, that's what really captivated my attention to both of your books, was really understanding from a business owner's perspective, whether people make rational or irrational decisions, it really becomes somewhat irrelevant to a certain extent, only in the sense that we just need to understand what type of behavior people are typically going to make and then adjust accordingly.
That's right. So, and that I think is kind of the right approach. I mean, who cares if it's rational or irrational? I mean, economists at universities should care, but people who are, you know, doing applied things in the real world should not care about one definition of rationality or not. They should care about, are they really capturing the essence of human motivation, and are they are we creating products and services that capitalize on this? Or are we creating products and services for people that behave differently than the people we actually observe in the real world?
Absolutely. And I think that was the first chapter in Predictably Irrational immediately grabbed me and pulled me in. Because the first chapter is called The Truth About Relativity. And what right on the very first page, you have a diagram showing the subscription options for The Economist magazine. Now, for everybody, the majority of people listening to this are typically going to be people who are creating some type of a subscription business, whether it be a membership site for quilt lovers or whether it be an online community. But there are subscription type elements that are involved in that, and that's why it immediately grabbed my attention. And what was so fascinating was the example and then how you took that base example and did a variety of experiments afterwards. Can you talk to us about what you found with the Economist subscription options and then what experiments you did afterwards?
Yeah. So imagine an offer that looks like the following. And this is the offer that the Economist offered a few years ago. You can have an online subscription for $59 a year. You could have a print for $125, or you could have a print and online for $125. Now, the first option seems kind of reasonable. The second option seems reasonable. But given that you have the third option, that you can have print and online for $125, why would anybody in the right mind will go for just print for $125? So the middle option of just print for $125 seems very, very odd. We go into this. I want you to reflect for a second about what a difficult decision this really is to decide if The Economist is worth $59 or not, the online version. I mean, look, how are you going to make this mental exercise? You know, we make decisions about money all day long, and because of that, we think we're experts. But the reality is that financial decisions are incredibly hard and complex. So if I asked you, is The Economist online worth $159, what mental exercise would you go through? I mean, would you compare it to 30 lattes or 18 lattes in Newsweek? Or, you know, it's when you think about it for a moment, you realize how difficult all financial decisions are. And what we find in general is that when people can't solve a problem in the right way, they solve it in the wrong way. And what the wrong way in this particular case means, use relativity. So imagine again, you have these two offer. One is $59 for online. One is $125 for online and print. And now I ask you, which one is better? Which one? The truth is, very, very hard to find out. But now we introduced a new option called print only for $125, and you still have no idea how much the top, the relevant two offers are. But now the print only for $125 makes the print and online for $125 look like a great deal.
Yeah, and it was fascinating to me because when I read it and looked at it, my immediate reaction was, well, obviously we would pick the print and web option. And when I asked colleagues and friends and people working in our office, almost everybody had the exact same reaction. We would pick the print and web option. But can you give people background on what happened thereafter?
Yeah, so we actually have done this in many cases. This is just one example. We've done it in physical attraction, where imagine that you can date either Tom or Jerry. And in one case, I have Tom, and Tom and Jerry are two very different people. And in one case, I add an uglier version of Tom. So you have Tom, ugly Tom and Jerry. And in another case, you have Tom, Jerry, and ugly Jerry, like a version that looks just slightly worse. And what happened is that when you add what we call the decoy, when you add ugly Jerry to the mix, Jerry looks more attractive. When you add ugly Tom to the mix, Tom relatively looks more attractive. And by the way, lots of startups have told me that they've used this trick in the last few years since I published this book, right? But I want us to kind of to understand what the fundamental issue is. The fundamental issue is that some attributes, some dimensions of products that we have a very hard time evaluating. In fact, it's many of them. But imagine I asked you, what is a reasonable liability to have on your car insurance? Or I asked you, how much are you willing to pay for something? Or I said, how many gears should you have on your bicycle? Lots of those decisions about these attributes are very, very hard to figure out because you don't know what's the right amount. So what do we do when we don't know what's the right amount? We look for shortcuts. That's what we call heuristics. And that's a very important point, is that we can't often access decision-making by looking perfectly at all the options that are in front of us. So we look for shortcuts. And it's about the people who design the environment that they can later go ahead and design the environment in a way that would get people to choose one way or another. This is what's called choice architecture, where the idea is that we think that people can make decisions, but the reality is that the environment of the decision can have a large effect on what people end up choosing. And I'll give you the most extreme example I know of this. It's a research by Dan Goldstein at Columbia. And here is what they did. They looked at people in different countries in Europe and how many of them donated their organ to donation after they passed away. And you would expect that this is a big, important decision and people would basically know if they want to donate their organs or not. But that's not what the results show. What the results show is that in countries that have the form, an enrollment form, imagine you go to the DMV, mm-hmm. and the enrollment form says, check the box below if you want to participate in the organ donation program, which basically means that if you don't check it, you're not in. What happened is about 80% of the people don't check and they don't join. But if you have a slightly different form that says, check the box below if you don't want to participate in the organ donation program, now about 90% of the people don't check, but they join.
Right. They join by default.
That's right. That's the offer or the idea of the default. But again, beyond the specific examples of the decoy effect and the default option, the real issue is that we just don't know how to make decisions. We use different tricks. And the people who design the environment in which we make decisions have a lot to say about what we'll end up choosing. And I'm guessing that most of your listeners are basically in those shoes. especially with online, the flexibility of creating different decision environments is very high. You know, it's a little hard to do it in physical stores, but of course you can do it as well. But online, one of the main benefits is you can actually control the decision environment, and the question is, how, by understanding the effect of the decision environment of the decision, you can actually get people to make different decisions.
Yeah, because it was fascinating to me as I was reading that chapter when you did the experiment by removing the print option. So now the only two options available were get the Economist subscription for a web version for $59 or get web and print for $125, and how removing the print-only option completely changed the dynamics and the decision that people would make as far as which subscription option they want. Because I myself, as well as people in our office and friends and colleagues, almost instantly switched to, okay, well, if those are the two options, then I would pick just web only. And from a business owner standpoint, that's a huge difference because, as you did with your testing, that can mean the difference of a transaction size of $125 versus $59, where, you know, it can almost double. Well, it did double the purchase amount just by adding, as you were saying, that decoy option or putting it in context. Because, as you were saying, it gives people something to compare to, and that makes the decision much easier.
So this, and this is kind of a crucial issue, is that you can sometimes add an option that nobody chooses, and nobody chooses it because it's an undesirable option, but because it gets people to think differently about the options that exist, it can actually change behavior, right? So it's a kind of a really bizarre idea that you can add option that nobody wants and nobody will ever choose, but nevertheless they can change how people make decisions.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me, and I'm smiling because as I read about the experiments that you did and the examples you gave, I almost always would try to, I would ask other people about how they felt about it, and I would, you know, monitor how I felt about it, and it was almost identical to the results that you were getting. So it was just fascinating, and I think, as you said, from a business owner's perspective, understanding the impact that we have over the environment and how we control that environment. And in fact, when I heard you, I was watching your presentations that you gave at TED, and in one of those presentations, you talked about the huge disparity between the countries that had a large number of people donate their organs versus the countries that did not. And it just brought a smile to my face when it came down to the checkbox options and whether somebody, you know, by default, it required them to take a step and in terms of changing the default options. And that's a pretty important thing to realize as a business owner too, especially if you're designing software or websites or anything of that nature, that the default options that we select often predict the options that most people end up using.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting is that it's very hard to have an intuition for this. And the reason is that we have this feeling that we make decisions all the time. We have this subjective feeling that we make decisions and we that we wake up and we decide what to wear and what to eat and so on and so forth. And because this illusion is so strong, it's very hard for us to understand that sometimes it's the environment that makes decisions for us.
Right.
Because we have a hard time having this intuition ourselves, we have a hard time thinking about how this would affect our clients or customers.
Yep. Well, if chapter one didn't pull me in, Dan, the third chapter, when you talked about the cost of zero, the cost of zero cost, or the cost of free, if you will, that was fascinating to me as well. And I was wondering if you could briefly just give our listeners some insight as to what that chapter was about, and then we'll talk about what that means to business owners.
Yeah, so this chapter is about whether free is just a low number, a low price, you know, 1 penny less than 1 cent, or whether it has kind of a special role that is beyond 1 penny less than 1 cent. And the way we did the experiment, we have lots and lots of them with kids, with adults, with gift certificates, with chocolates. But the way we did it is we said, look, you can take one of two items. You can either take a high-quality chocolate for, let's say, 13 cents or a Hershey Kiss for one penny. So people had a choice between a good chocolate, a very good chocolate, a 13 cents or a Hershey Kiss for one penny. And in this case, when both products cost something, almost everybody took the high-quality chocolate and not the Hershey Kiss. And then we discounted both products by one penny. So now instead of 13 at one, it was 12 and zero. Now, because people could choose one of the two, and only one of the two, every time you would take one chocolate, you would give up the other one, right? So it's a question of what's the quality difference and what's the price difference between the two. And the quality difference doesn't change when you reduce both prices by one penny, and the price difference doesn't change. So, rationally speaking, people should choose the same thing. But what happened when it's 13 and 12 and zero? Virtually everybody goes to the free Hershey Kiss, and by doing that, they give up the better option. That's kind of the important thing, right? They don't. You know, if you offer stuff for free, people should take it because there's no cost.
Right.
But what's interesting is that people are so excited about free that they're willing to give up another option for it. And here's one way to think about it. Imagine I offer you two credit cards. One had a 15% interest rate, and it cost you nothing. And the other one had a 9% interest rate, but it cost you $100 a year.
Right.
Which one would you choose? If you're overexcited about free, you might go for the 15% interest rate and then not pay any initiation fee. But then if you get to have a late payment or you miss a period and so on, you might actually get stuck with a much higher bill. And that's what people do. Or another example is, think about how long you would stand in line to get a free Ben & Jerry's ice cream.
Yeah.
Right? Compared to how much would you stand in line to get, a salary increase of $1.75. This, by the way, this excitement about free is kind of an interesting downward spiral that is kind of killing the banking industry. You know, if you think about it, the banks are basically not charging us for checking accounts or debit cards and credit cards, and the way they afford it is that they basically screw over the people who are late.
Right.
So you and I are probably never paying for a checking account, but people who are late by a payment or miss something get stuck with a $35 charge every time they overdraft with their debit card by $1 or they return the check or something. Because we have this excitement about free, the banks have given us free, but at the same time, found other ways to charge for it. And now the government is not going to let them do it anymore. And the question is, what will they do and how could they get out of this spiral? Because once you start offering things for free, it's very hard to get out of it. But by the way, let me say two more things that kind of connect the two points we talked about so far. One is that I think if you think about the Internet 0.0 in the early days, the basic idea was you'll provide services for people, they will experience it, they would realize how wonderful it is, and then they would be willing to pay $19.95 for this. But the problem is that when we act in certain ways, it's very hard for us to understand the benefit of something in dollar terms. So rather than understanding how valuable, Pointcast or Alta Vista or whatever it is, and then be willing to pay for it, people said to themselves, well, I paid nothing for it. Let me keep on paying nothing. And because zero is such a tempting price, it's very, very hard to escape. So you can think about how the whole Internet could have been different if we, as people who create websites, did not condition people from the beginning that they should view the Internet as a free, source of free things.
There's so many elements of that chapter, Dan, that are relevant to us as business owners. I mean, from one perspective, the concept of free we've used in our business. We've done promotions where people will get an extra item for free by buying our product during a certain period of time. And almost always, our sales will spike. Almost always. Because that free component is something that people not only want, but as you mentioned in the book, there's almost the fear of loss that we won't have it. And so that from that standpoint, the power of free is very, very powerful from a business owner standpoint. But then I'd also love to get your thoughts on something that's, you know, really developing right now and is a discussion certainly amongst a lot of business owners and certainly people in that have subscription-based services like what we're sharing with here today. And that is the topic of freemium, where you give free to a certain extent, but if people want the bells and whistles or little extras, then they begin paying for it. Does this begin to have an effect on what you talked about in that chapter?
Yeah, so the freemium model, you know, it's a really nice idea, but it has a one basic problem, is that it's very hard to move people away from free. So imagine you have two prices, you have zero and you have $19. It turns out that $19 is more than $19 more than free.
Right.
But if the cheap one was a dollar, and then you charge $20 is $19 more than free, and more than $1. So there's an inherent problem with free, where it's so attractive to people that the chances that they'll move to a paid model is very low. So, you know, it's of course it's a better model to have that than to have everything for free. But the ideal is to try and think about something that even the cheap model, the cheap version is not free. And I'll give you a couple of suggestions. Imagine, for example, that I offered you a service, but instead of giving and calling it free, I told you, I said, look, Stu, I really value your opinion. Mm-hmm. So what I'll do is I will waive the charge for the first 3 months if you promise to spend 15 minutes or 10 minutes at the end of this 3 months and tell me what you thought about my product.
Yep.
Now, you still give it for free, so it has all the things about getting people to, you know, participate and not have a high entry cost. But now what you're telling people is not that it's free, but you're telling them that you actually value their opinions, right? And hopefully you really do.
Yeah.
And therefore you're not creating the starting price of free, but you're starting with something that says, hey, this is something that's worth $19.95, but it turns out that my time as a user is also worth something.
Yeah.
So, you know, free has a lot of advantages, right? There's no downside. People get very excited, very emotional about it. So all that works for free. The problem is a really hard business model to keep. I mean, even look at Google. How many things are Google really making money on?
Right.
How much are they losing?
Yeah, because the lion's share of their revenue comes from one particular source, and that's their AdWords or their advertising.
Right.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating topic, and it's certainly something that's discussed a lot amongst people who are providing membership sites or subscription sites, because, you know, getting people in the door is something that we all want more of, and so free naturally gets a lot more people in the door. But what I'm hearing you say is that getting people from that free mindset to a paid mindset, that's a very, very difficult battle to engage in. And, you know, it's one of those situations where we always got to weigh, you know, is it worth the cost and effort on the owner's standpoint versus just providing the same service at a low price point to get people in the door versus the free.
Yeah. And I think it's a myopic, problematic model. So again, if you think about it, what are you assuming? When you get people to come and join something for free, what are you assuming? You're assuming that they will come and join in big masses, and that's a reasonable assumption. But then you're assuming that at some point they would take what they've done and start be willing to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the assumption we need to question. I mean, by now we have enough data on this. It's not just my experiments.
Yeah.
Right? So this, and I think this kind of is a good idea in general, right, is to say, let me break my process or my hypothesized process into pieces, and let me kind of be explicit about what I'm assuming.
Right. Yeah, there was so many elements of that chapter that just pulled me in, and it really got my mind working as far as, number one, how to properly use free, because we know that people react to free, and how to use that in a way that everybody wins, and then also to be aware of it as a business owner, that it can also be, as we've talked about here today, a downfall, because once people get in that mindset and are conditioned to free, it's very difficult to break them out of that. And so,
that I think is the important insight. I think everybody would say free is great. The first insight is free is more great than one penny less than 1 cent. It's really amazingly great, and the reason is that people don't see downsides to it. Even when they are, because they give up better options. Imagine you had a 1 week vacation. That's it. You had 1 week time a year to have a vacation, and I offered you a free vacation. Or I offered something that would cost $1,000. You know, you have 1 week of vacation, right? It's something to cherish, to wait for, to experience, to remember later. But the free might be so tempting that you would give up a fantastic vacation that would remain with you for a long time because the other one is free. So free is overly exciting. That's the first kind of thing that people don't understand. But the second thing is that once you've established free as a price in people's mind, it's very hard to convince them that it's actually worth something, that they're actually willing to pay, because this model of experiencing something, understanding the benefit of it, and therefore be willing to pay, doesn't seem to pan out. Instead, what happens is people look at something, they enjoy it, but then they're going to say, I'm going to keep on paying what I've paid so far, which is nothing.
Right. Yeah, it was so many great lessons we can learn from that. And there's one other element that I want to talk to you about with in regards to the first book, Predictably Rational. And then I want to shift gears and I want to talk to you certainly about the new book that you've released, because that there's a lot of wealth that we can learn from that as well. But before we do, the last thing I want to talk to you about in Predictably Rational was Chapter 9, the Effect of Expectations. And for me, this was a really intriguing chapter from a marketing perspective, in the sense that how we... for example, one of the things that you mentioned in the book was that marketing is providing information that will heighten someone's anticipated and real pleasure. And what you basically talked about in that chapter was how our expectations going into or using a product or experiencing a service dramatically impacts the actual perceived experience that we have.
It's not just perceived, it's the real experience. I mean, the thing to understand is that the way we experience the world is partially about what's happening in the real world, and it's partially what happens in our brains. Right? So if you ask how much pleasure you have from anything, from a movie, from a book, from sex, I mean, from anything, it turns out that part of your pleasure is about what happens in your brain. I think it was Woody Allen that said that the most important organ for sex is the brain.
Right.
Right. Now this is important to understand. Now, it means that if I can play with your brain in terms of what you expect and what you think and how you define the event and so on, I can actually give you a different experience.
Mm.
And one of the nicest demonstrations of this was a study by Reed Montague and Sam McClure, that they basically did the old Coke and Pepsi experiment.
Yep.
So you remember in the old Coke and Pepsi blind taste testing, Coke showed people two cans, and they said, which one do you like more? And people like Coke. And Pepsi did the same thing. They said, which one do you like more? And people said Pepsi. Well, it turns out the difference was that Coke was doing it in a non-blind way. You could see the cans, and then people preferred Coke. And Pepsi did it in a blind way, and then people did Pepsi. This, by the way, was what Coke didn't understand when they did New Coke, because when they did New Coke, they did lots and lots of very extensive testing with people, and they tried different versions and so on. And it turns out at the end that they created a version of Coke that was sweeter, that was more similar to Pepsi. But once they put it in the Coke can, people hated it because they wanted Coke. So what Sam and Reed did was they put people in an fMRI machine, a machine that images your brain, and they gave you either Coke or Pepsi, and either told you that it was Coke or Pepsi or didn't. And when you didn't know what it was, you know, this brown sugary liquid had an effect on people's pleasure center in the brain, and it was undistinguishable of whether it was Coke or Pepsi. But when they told people it was either Coke or Pepsi, the Coke knowledge activated the front part of the brain, not the emotional part of the brain, which is kind of is the center, kind of the pleasure emotional part of the brain, but it activated the frontal part of the brain, the part of the brain that has to do with association and higher order thinking and so on. And what happened was that it turns out that this frontal part of the brain that is in charge of by higher order association actually has a projection to the pleasure center of the brain. So when you see Coke, you see the can, unbeknownst to you, it activates ideas you have, a association, maybe about what it is to be American, and maybe pride, and maybe ideas about barbecuing in the summer, and so on. And those activation in this association actually projects to the pleasure center of the brain and change the amount of pleasure you actually are then having from the Coke. So is it the same drink? No, it's actually not the same drink, but the reason that they're so different, the reason Coke and Pepsi are different is not so much the formula. It's the thoughts and ideas and association that come from consuming them. And that's all marketing, right? So advertising and marketing and association.
Yeah, and that's what really grabbed me because, you know, it really emphasized to me as a business owner the importance of word-of-mouth marketing and why that's so powerful. Because I think one of the other little examples you gave in the book was talking about how hearing good reviews from friends and families about a movie will actually increase the experience that we have when we actually go to see the movie.
That's right. So there's a question about the information in general, and then, of course, there's the question of where do you get the source of information. So this is actually stuff I don't talk about in either of the books. It's stuff we're just doing right now. But one of the things we're finding is that trust in companies is really eroding. So you can ask, why do people listen to their friends, right? The truth is that if I wanted to buy a new insurance for my car, my friends don't know much about insurance. You know, they know a little bit about it. They maybe have an agent that they like, but they're not experts. Similar digital cameras, right? My friends know something about it, but they don't really know a lot. So there is stuff that is about idiosyncrasy. So you could say, for example, books, you know, maybe if my friends are similar to me, so for books I should ask them questions, or for movies I should ask them questions. But things about cars, insurance, other things, there's no reason to ask friends because they really don't know. But it turns out that because we have such an erosion in our trust for companies, social networks are kind of starting to pull in, even in cases when they really shouldn't, that the information is not that good, but that's the problem. So, you know, here's an example. We ask people very obvious questions like, is the sun yellow? Is the camel bigger than a dog? Stuff like that. And when people just told a statement like this. They said yes, 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 or no, 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 depending on if it's framed in which direction. But when we told them that the statement came from a big company like Procter & Gamble, all of a sudden they started doubting it. For example, they said, oh, yeah, the sun is yellow, but it has other spots. And the camel is bigger than a dog, but what about if it's a big Dane and the camel was just born? So what happened is there's a real erosion of trust that provides incredible opportunities, I think, for companies, for small companies to come ahead, and, of course, how to use social networking as well.
Right. And I think, you know, what I'm gathering from what you're saying there is that, you know, in the past, it was always, you know, information and trust or the information and source. But now the source is beginning to play a much bigger role in the way that people perceive and the experience that they have with different products and services.
Yep, yep. Actually, there's one thing that is really disturbing. So we gave people a stereo from a company called Cambridge Soundworks. It's a relatively good company and make good stereo, and people trust it. So it has a good brand name. It's not one of those terrible brand names. And we gave people a brochure about this stereo that came. We told them it came from either Cambridge Soundworks, from the marketing department of Cambridge Soundworks, or we told them it came from Consumer Reports. And then we let them play for an hour with the stereo. And it turns out that they thought the stereo was much worse when they when they got the information from Cambridge Soundworks, and they were willing to pay about half as much for it.
Wow.
So the way that we experience the world is influenced by our expectations. Our expectations increase, depend on the type of knowledge we get plus the source of the information. And sadly, because what marketing companies have done over the years, our trust in companies is eroding. And therefore, our expectation from what they say is lower, and therefore our experience is lower.
Very fascinating stuff. Well, Dan, I thank you for certainly giving us insights into that. I want to talk to you certainly about the new book, which is The Upside of Irrationality. There were a lot of elements from the new book that I loved. And I want to certainly emphasize to everybody the subtitle of it, because it's The Upside of Irrationality, The Unexpected Benefits of Defying Logic at Work and at Home. And this book was fantastic because it gave really an understanding, now that we understand predictably rational and that these things happen, how does that affect us, certainly at work and at home? And chapter one, you open up with a bang again with a sensitive issue that certainly people are going to certainly be aware of and understand, and that is the concept of providing big bonuses at work. And certainly with the banking industry and everything that's happened in the economy, that's certainly something that people have an opinion on one way or the other. Can you talk to us about what bonuses do as far as improving performance? Because as business owners, inevitably, we likely are working with different clients, outsource workers or employees or contract workers. So the concept of a bonus is something certainly that many of us have either experienced ourselves or we are utilizing in our business to help motivate employees. And you found some very interesting conclusions in regards to the size of the bonus and how that affects performance.
Yeah. So here is kind of, before I tell you the results, here's the way to think about it. Think about what it means to put a bonus in front of somebody. It means that you don't think that they're sufficiently motivated naturally to do the job, right? Mm-hmm. You say, hey, if I didn't pay them this bonus, they would sit on the beach drinking mojitos, so I need to put some incentives in front of them to do it. And I wanted to do it so big, so large, that it would capture their motivation and attention and thoughts all the time. Now, it turns out that's a very good strategy for really boring tasks. So, for example, if I ask you to jump or lay bricks or do things that are just about labor, there's no problem. But it turns out it can easily backfire when the task can involve things that demand creativity, concentration, memory. Because imagine, for example, that you have a brain surgeon who is going to create a sensitive operation on you, and you told them, you know what, surgeon, if you'll do well on this brain surgery, I'll give you a yacht. and if you don't, I'll sue you.
Right.
Do you really want them to think half of the time when they operate to think about their bonus or their lawsuit?
No, I don't want them thinking of either.
That's right. So there's something called a state of flow, which is the idea that you're in 100% focused on the task and kind of committed to it, and it's 100% engaging. And when you give people very high bonuses, you actually decrease the state of flow. So I don't want to say that bonuses are always bad. I just want to say two things. The first one is that human motivation is, in fact, quite complex. We work for lots of reasons. We work for pride, and we work for personal meaning, and we work for feeling of connection and feeling of achievement, and we work because of social reasons. And money is good, and money is part of the story, but it's not all of the story. So that's the first thing, right? Let's just recognize the complexity of human motivation. The second thing is to say, and now let's look specifically about how we optimize things, and what do bonuses do? And then you say, well, what bonuses do is they create another path of motivation that is not about your natural motivation, it's an external motivation. And when can those work and when they can't work? And what we basically find is that very big bonuses can very easily undermine it. And again, people don't have a good intuition about it. So you ask people, what will big bonuses do to people? And they say they will work much, they will try much harder, and they will succeed much more. Well, it turns out the first half of this is correct. People try much harder, but they don't necessarily succeed more. And in the banking case, you know, just ask yourselves. I mean, eventually, these are all public banks. I mean, forget the government. They're public banks. You know, just because we are shareholders. And the question is giving people these kind of salaries really make them more effective? And I think the answer is clearly no. By the way, I've talked to many bankers about this over the years, but one thing that they admit, they never admit they don't deserve that money, they never admit they get overstressed, but what they do admit is that every day, basically, they open a little Excel spreadsheet and they calculate how much bonus they're expecting this year, right? But imagine that you and me were the same, right? Imagine 80% of our salary was dependent on the bonus, and during October, November, and December, wouldn't you continuously try to figure out how much money you're making?
Absolutely, yeah. It would dominate your what you're thinking about.
Right.
Yeah, it was really fascinating, and I think for me as a business owner, because you know we have people in our company. And you knowing the information in that chapter really gave me insight as to how to modify and change the way that we reward people in our company.
Yeah.
And I thought it was just a great chapter to open with. The next
You know, by the way, I was in Seattle a few weeks ago, and I got to meet both with Amazon and with Microsoft.
Oh, interesting.
And they both told me horror stories about a compensation scheme that they tried to create that you were just terrible.
And so what ended up working for them?
Well, I can't tell you kind of the details of how they messed things up. But they said that both of them, in both cases, the agreement was that they overestimated how important money is for people and dramatically underestimated other motivations.
Interesting.
Dramatically underestimated kind of sense of meaning and purpose and a collaboration between people, and by focusing people on specific financial goals, basically distracted people from actually working much more effectively.
And I think that's great insight for any business owner, because as you were saying, the number one thing to realize is that money is only part of the mix. It's not the only piece of the puzzle, if you will.
And we should pay people. We should pay them nicely, but when you give people, for example, you know, 3% of their salary is determined on performance, you're asking yourself, you know, what are you really shifting in people's minds and attention?
Right.
And is this only for the best?
All right, Dan. Well, thank you so much for your time today. There's so much more that I want to talk to you about as far as the upside of irrationality. perhaps we can schedule a part two. Does that sound good?
With pleasure. We can also meet for coffee at some point. It's more fun.
Sounds great. All right, Dan. Well, thank you so much for your time. We look forward to part two, where we start discussing a lot more of your second book, The Upside of Irrationality.
Great talking to you. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye.
Isn't it fascinating to hear how customer behavior and decision-making can be so irrational and yet become so predictable, in the sense that we can begin understanding more about our customers and creating products and selling environments that help them make decisions easier? Well, in part two of this interview series, we're again going to be talking with Dan Ariely, more focusing on the concepts from his brand new book, The Upside of Irrationality. In this interview, we're going to begin exploring a number of different topics, starting with customer revenge and how customer revenge is actually increasing. As you heard in this first interview, trust in big brands and companies is decreasing dramatically. As a result, customers are responding in a revengeful way. Well, in this interview, we're going to be talking to Dan about the importance of customer service and how both you as a business owner and people working within your company affect the experience that your customers have, and certainly the outlook on whether they take revenge on you or not. Then we're also going to be talking about empathy and emotion, and how emotions play a big role in the experience your customers have, both before, during, and after using your particular product or service. We also talk about how it affects giving. So for nonprofit or charitable organizations, you're definitely going to want to tune in for this. And lastly, we're also going to begin exploring the long-term effects of short-term emotions. I'm going to be asking him about self-hurting and what that does and how it affects our daily lives. We're also going to be talking about how specific emotions affect our decisions and how as business owners and how we can create different emotions in our customers, both before they purchase and certainly during their purchase and experience using the product or service. So I'm very much looking forward to part two of this interview, and I hope you do too. So stay tuned for more interviews with best-selling authors, successful entrepreneurs, corporate CEOs, and popular bloggers as we continue our Wishlist Products interview series, helping entrepreneurs achieve more with the best tools, software, and information on the web. This interview was sponsored by WishlistMember.com, the most effective way for building community around your product, service, or brand. If you would like a fast and user-friendly way to build your own online membership site, visit www.wishlistmember.com. That's www.wishlistmember.com. We'll see you in part two of the next interview.